A year passed. Debts accumulated, but nothing came in to meet them. No doubt her sunshiny Creole disposition enabled her to drift along, shutting her eyes to the critical facts of her position or hoping to be presently delivered from them by a miracle. Some such miracle, perhaps, is her aunt had encountered in the person of Monsieur de Beauharnais at the places of amusement she frequented and in the so-called society of the day, a society that came together in public gardens where good company was to be had for a few pence. Josephine had made a few acquaintances who exerted themselves on her behalf and effected the restitution of some few acres that had belonged to her husband, but she had realized and was gradually consuming these other resources. She had none. The nominal dowry of 100,000 francs she had received at her marriage was to have produced an income at 5% interest on the capital, but her father died. Her mother was left in poverty, and the West Indian colonies were blockaded by the English. She had further been portioned by her aunt, Madame Renaudin, with the reversion of certain properties which had since been sold, and with claims on certain creditors which had lapsed. This, however, was of little moment, for the lady could not live on reversion. Madame Renaudin gave her some little help, which she supplemented by loans from complacent bankers who accepted drafts on Martinique and who even advised her to go to Hamburg, where she would be able to receive remittances more easily. But her credit was waning, her years increasing. What card had she yet to play? At this critical juncture, General Bonaparte rang at the outer gate to return the Vicomtesse de Beauharnais' call. He did not know that the house belonged to the citoyenne Talma and was in fact a present from a rich protector of the days when she was known as Mademoiselle Julie. Nor did he know that the house and its surrounding 1,200 meters of land in the outlying quarter of the city, close to the Rue Saint-Lazare, was worth barely 50,000 francs, the sum it fetched in 1781, and was again to fetch in 1796, the gate having been opened by a concierge. For concierge there was, the general traversed the long passage, on one side of which he saw the stables with two black horses of about 7 years old and a red cow. The coach house on the other side discreetly concealed its shabby carriage. The passage gave admittance to a garden in the center of which stood the dwelling house. On the ground floor were four lofty windows surmounted by a low attic story. The kitchens were underground. Bonaparte passed up four stone steps to a terrace platform enclosed by plain balusters and entered an anteroom, the scanty furniture of which consisted of a copper urn, an oaken chest, and a deal covered. The manservant, Gontier, conducted him into a small dining room and left him to seat himself on one of the four horsehair chairs near the round mahogany table or to examine the half dozen prints in black and gold frames on the walls. There was little of luxury in his surroundings, but remnants of former elegance were scattered here and there in the shape of tables and dumbwaiters of mahogany and the yellow wood of Guadeloupe, with marble tops and gilded copper moldings, while in two large cupboards with glass doors, a tea urn, some vases, and a series of table accessories in Britannia metal did their best to supply the place of silver. Of this latter commodity, the house could boast no more than 14 spoons, 15 forks and a soup ladle, 6 soup spoons and 11 coffee spoons. But of all this, Bonaparte knew nothing. Josephine, fresh from the hands of her maid, the citoyenne Louise Comfoin, emerges from her dressing room and hastens into the dining room to receive this visitor, the harbinger of better fortunes. She cannot well receive him elsewhere, for on the ground floor she has only, besides the dining room, a little semicircular chamber of which she has made a dressing room and her bedroom. The latter is pleasant, but simple enough. The furniture is upholstered in blue yankeen with a pine pattern of blue and red. The little bed is of plain wood. A few more elegant pieces of furniture made of mahogany or of the yellow wood of Guadeloupe complete the plenishing, together with a harp by Renault and a little bust of Socrates in white marble, the only ornament of the room. In the dressing room, The most important feature after Piano by Bernard were the mirrors. One stood on a large dressing table, another on a mahogany chest of drawers, a third on a side table, while a fourth, an ornamental glass with two panels, crowned the mantel shelf. Such were the household goods of this lady of fashion. Her table was served with earthenware, except on great occasions for which she received a dozen blue and white china plates. The table in it consisted of 8 tablecloths, so much the worse for wear that they, together with the table napkins, were valued at 4 livres in Josephine's inventory. But Bonaparte knew nothing of this. How should he know that the charming woman before him, whose infinite grace dazzles him, whose tasteful costume is a positive feast to the eye, possesses in all but 4 dozen chemises, a good deal worn, 2 dozen handkerchiefs, 6 petticoats, 6 night jackets, 6 pockets, 18 lawn handkerchiefs, and a dozen pairs of silk stockings of different colors. As a set off, however, to this meager linen closet, she owns 6 muslin scarves, 2 taffeta gowns of brown and violet, respectively, 3 muslin dresses embroidered in colors, 3 plain muslin dresses, 2 of Indian muslin, 3 of cambric, 1 summer taffeta gown, 3 of woolen material, and 1 of white embroidered lawn. The scanty underlinen and the comparative wealth of outer garments is characteristic of Josephine. Her 6 petticoats, as against her 16 frocks, reveal the woman. But all this matters little. Bonaparte sees only the dress, or rather, he sees only the wearer. Her chestnut hair, fine and silky rather than abundant, was less remarkable for quantity than quality in those days of blonde wigs and powder. Her skin, somewhat brown in color and no longer youthfully smooth on the face, owed not a little of its bloom to rouge and white paint. Her teeth were bad, and she never displayed them, the dainty mouth wearing invariably a faint, sweet smile in charming harmony with the infinite sweetness of the deeply fringed eyes, the tender expression of the features, and the exquisite modulations of a voice which in later years, it is said, would cause the very servants passing along the corridors to pause and listen. A delicate nose, small, mobile, slightly retroussé, the nostrils quivering at the least emotion, was not the least provocative feature of her attractive face. The face, however, was insignificant as compared with the beautifully molded figure and long, lithe limbs, terminating in a pair of dainty feet arched in center, the feet of a queen made for homage and kisses. We can divine their form and texture, see them, feel them almost, as we look at the shoes that once encased them of stays or any artificial support. Her figure was innocent, the slender and even meager development of the bust enabling her to dispense with such contrivances. Hers was an individual charm that triumphed over minor defects, an elegance of which she alone possessed the secret. It was said of her that she even went to bed gracefully. Her grace was due to the perfect proportion of the supple limbs, to the lissome figure and proportion, which resulted in an easy elegance of movement that made her seem tall, though she was really of mediocre height. Add to all this a profound knowledge of effect and pose and gesture and coquetry that displayed itself in infinite refinement, neglecting no opportunity and leaving nothing to chance, and that indefinable languor that makes the Creole the most essentially feminine of women, that sensuous, elegant, vague yet intoxicating, that seems to pervade the facile abandon of her personality, was not the vision one that might have charmed the most experienced? How much more than such a novice as Bonaparte? Captivated by the woman, he was dazzled by the lady, awed by her air of dignity and breeding, the calm and noble bearing of the old French aristocracy, as he himself expresses it. She, for her part, saw that he was one. He returned the next day and the next. Soon no day passed without a visit from him, and when he found Madame de Beauharnais surrounded by personages of the late court, men whose birth seemed to him of the highest compared with his own petty gentility, as he called it, when he saw her treated as a friend, an equal, in fact, somewhat as a comrade by Segur, a Montesquieu, a Caulaincourt, he did not detect the shade of familiarity in their bearing, nor does he seem to have been struck by the fact that these men, whose prestige was so great in his eyes, paid their visits alone, and that their wives were never seen in Madame de Beauharnais' salon, fresh from the Jacobinical society in which he had lived at Vaucluse, at Toulon, at Nice, and in Paris, and to which he owed his promotion. He felt an infinite satisfaction at finding himself in such company. He took appearances for realities, and, dazzled by his senses, continued to accept them as such. For all here was equally unreal. The lady's wealth, birth, position, and apparent social standing. A fortnight after the first meeting, Bonaparte was her lover. The letters exchanged at this date seemed to imply that as yet there was only friendship between them, but says a contemporary, delicate transitions were unusual in those tumultuous times, and progress was rapid. They loved each other passionately. It was natural enough in his case, and it seems not unlikely that Josephine herself was sincere at this stage. Bonaparte was a new experience for her, a savage to tame, the lion of the day to lead about captive. The dawn of passion in the young man, his southern ardor and youthful fire, his rapturous worship of her personality, were homage that could not fail to touch a woman of her age. A delicious evidence that she was still beautiful, that she would never lose her charm. But it was as a lover he commended himself to her, not as a husband. And now he offers her his hand. He presses her to become his wife. After all, she has little to lose by such a transaction. She's desperate, and this may be a winning hazard. He is young, ambitious. He commands the army of the interior. The directory remembers that he furnished the plans for the last campaign in Italy. Carnot is prepared to give him the command in the next. This way, perhaps, salvation lies. And at the worst, she enters into a contract for which she can easily seek relief in a divorce, if need be, for there is no question of priests or a religious ceremony. What is there then to fear? The bargain will hold good as long as the contracting parties are pleased to observe it, but it is one which will not be considered binding either by the woman's conscience or by the opinion of her former world, if that should trouble itself at all in the matter, and a great stake worth winning may be the portion of the skillful player in such a game, for the young man may rise to great heights. If he should be killed, there's always the pension. She takes certain precautions, nevertheless. First of all, she busies herself with the falsification of her age, for she cannot own to 32, either to a lover of 26, or anyone else. Camille, her business advisor, the guardian of her children, goes to a notary in company with a certain Lesueur. They declare themselves perfectly acquainted with Marie-Joseph Tascher, widow of the citizen Beauharnais, and certify that she was born at Martinique in the Windward Islands, and that it is at present impossible for her to procure a certificate of her birth, owing to the occupation of the island by the English. This was all. There was no further declaration, and no dates were given. Armed with this document, Josephine informed the registrar of the civil marriage that she was born on June 23rd, 1767, whereas she was, as a fact, born on June 23rd, 1763. But she was not pressed very closely on this point. She determined to keep up a similar fiction with regard to her means. She seemed more difficult at the first blush, but Bonaparte was in a mood to be readily cajoled. The most extraordinary marriage contract ever received by a notary was drawn up privately in the presence only of Le Marois, the general's aide-de-camp. No community of goods of any kind, or in any degree, each contracting party to have the sole control of his or her property, all administrative power secured to the future wife by the future husband in advance, the children of the first marriage to be under the sole guardianship of the mother, a jointure, 1,500 livres per annum in the event of her becoming a widow, in which event she should also be entitled to take possession of all goods she may certify as her own. There is no mention of other settlements Oh, the future wife's property, said to be secured to the joint estate of herself and the late Monsieur de Beauharnais. No inventory has as yet been made, and until this was done, she could not be called upon either to accept or renounce. When 2 years later, the inventory was drawn up, she renounced her claims, fortune having brought better things. In the interim, Bonaparte's avowal of his poverty was made with less circumlocution. On his part, the future husband declares that he owns neither lands nor goods beyond his personal wardrobe and his military accoutrements, the whole value by him at blank, which he assigns. This was indeed, as the notary said, to Madame de Beauharnais, the proverbial cloak and sword. The general, however, came to the conclusion that the declaration was superfluous and struck the paragraph out of the contract. The document bears the date Ventose 18, year 4, March 8, 1796. The marriage took place the next day before the registrar, who obligingly described the bridegroom as 28 years old instead of 26, and the bride as 29 instead of 32. He was evidently an official with a strong sense of proportion. Barras, Lamoureux, who was still a minor, Tallien, and the inevitable Camelet were the witnesses. No reference was made to the consent of the parents on either side. They had not been consulted. 2 days later, General Bonaparte left to join the army of Italy. Madame Bonaparte remained in the Rue Chateau. Fortunately, they had anticipated the honeymoon.